From WUFTFM, this is Animal Airwaves Live, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and for this episode airing March 19th, 2021, our topic is congestive heart failure in pets living their best life possible. And I'm really happy to welcome to the program today for the first time from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Darcy Aden. Dr. Aden, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dana.
Congestive heart failure. It sounds like a really terrible thing. Heart failure is like the worst kind of failure.
Yes, we use the term congestive heart failure to describe the fluid accumulation that occurs when something is wrong with the heart structurally. And that could be because of a leaky heart valve or because the muscle is too weak or potentially too thick. And so animals and people can live with a degree of heart disease without knowing it and being asymptomatic. But once that dysfunction reaches a point that compensatory mechanisms are no longer sufficient, then fluid will build up. And typically it builds up in the lungs, making it difficult to breathe. And so when there's congestion or extra fluid, we use the term congestive heart failure.
Okay. So this is a problem that actually affects different systems in the body. And that is important because it means that we should maybe take a look at what is involved here. We are talking about the heart, which is a muscle and does the vital work of circulating the blood. Can you talk a little bit about the anatomy of the heart so that during our conversation, I'll kind of understand the components that we're addressing?
Sure, of course. Our heart is, the human heart is very similar to the heart of dogs and cats. They both have four chambers. There are two bottom chambers called the ventricles and two top chambers called the atria. And the heart can also be divided into the left side and the right side. So on the left side, the left atrium receives blood from the lungs, and then it enters the left ventricle, which pumps it out to the body, so to the brain and the kidneys and all the muscles. Then blood goes through capillaries, which are very small, tiny vessels, and returns back to the heart through the veins. And the veins enter the right atrium, then blood goes into the right ventricle, and the right ventricle pumps the blood out to the lungs, where the blood then becomes oxygenated because of breathing and returns back to the left side of the heart.
And this happens, you know, with our pets, what, 100 beats a minute? I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the average pulse is for a dog or a cat, but I mean, it's happening constantly. And any disruption would be bad, but also any kind of loss of function will probably reveal itself in some clinical signs.
Yes, that's correct. And the heart rate of animals is quite variable depending on the species. So dogs, we have a wide range of size of dog as well. And so some small breeds can be as small as a couple pounds. And then we have dogs that are as large as 150 to 180 pounds sometimes. And so sometimes those larger breed dogs have slightly slower heart rates, maybe on average 60 to 80, whereas the smaller breed dogs might be more like 90 to 100. So there is a little bit of variability there. And then, of course, cats have much higher heart rates. When we see them in the hospital, they can be upwards of 180 or 200 because of the hospital environment, but they're still 100 to 120 at home. So there's a lot of variability in that heart rate. But you are absolutely correct that if that is happening every day from day one, 100 beats a minute for every minute of the animal's life. And so any disruption in either the rate or the rhythm or the pumping capacity or the relaxing capacity, anything that disrupts those normal, smoothly functioning processes can result in downstream effects, which can be the fluid retention, which causes congestive heart failure and trouble breathing, or it could result in not enough blood being pumped forward and causing weakness and fainting.
On this program before, I've spoken with some of your colleagues about the renal system, and I've learned that the kidneys can experience quite a bit of malfunctioning before symptoms are observable. Is that true with the heart, or are even mild degradations in the functioning of the heart visible right away?
It's generally true for the heart as well. And so when we see dogs and cats that are brought to us as veterinarians because they're having signs of heart failure or heart dysfunction, they have often had underlying kind of quiescent heart disease for months, if not years sometimes. And so the body is really good at enacting these compensatory mechanisms that kind of make up for the loss. But there becomes a point when that's not possible to hide anymore, and that's when we start to see symptoms. But it's usually been going on for quite a while before we see them.
Well, that I find alarming, because that means that you don't necessarily have the opportunity to address this early on, when perhaps measures could be taken to counteract some of the negative results. If you're finding these patients who have been experiencing this and not showing signs, could it be that the disease has progressed substantially?
Yeah, and that's where the relationship with a primary veterinarian is very important, because a dog or a cat can appear pretty healthy to an owner, but a veterinarian might pick up on a heart murmur or an irregular heartbeat or something that would be a warning that, hey, we better look into this a little bit more, because if we catch disease at an early stage, we may be able to reverse it or treat it or slow the progression of it. And so even though the outward symptoms might wait till the more terminal disease, there are often things that can be detected by a primary veterinarian that might help us intervene earlier.
What is the veterinarian listening for primarily, or maybe even through some other kind of imaging? What are you trying to discern when you're focusing on the heart?
Yeah, so probably a common scenario might be an owner taking their dog or cat in for annual examination and vaccines by their family veterinarian. And that veterinarian would typically do a full physical examination, as well as ask questions that might be important for that relate to family history potential or signs of weakness or, subtle signs like that. But they're going to do a full physical exam. And so the things that might alert us to there being a problem with the heart would be anything related to the cardiovascular system or the respiratory system. And so the veterinarian will typically look at the gum color, which can be an indication of how well the blood is being pumped forward and how well perfusion is happening. They will also look at any of the veins that are on the surface of the body to see if they look distended, maybe too full of fluid. Then they will also get out their stethoscope and listen to the heartbeat. And this is probably the most important aspect of the cardiac exam. The stethoscope can help us to hear the heart sounds, which tell us whether there's a heart murmur present. And a heart murmur typically could indicate a leaky blood valve or an partially obstructed blood valve. Cardiac valve. And so if there is leaky blood happening because a valve is not functioning properly, then that will be heard through a stethoscope as a heart murmur, and that will alert that veterinarian that we might need more diagnostics. And sometimes those diagnostic tests might be performed in their vet hospital, such as doing a set of chest x-rays to look at how big the heart is and whether there is any fluid retention. But it might also be a good opportunity to refer that pet to a veterinary cardiologist who can then go a step further and do an ultrasound of the heart, which is probably our most common test to understand the structure and function of the heart and whether it is compromised or potentially is failing. The other thing that they will listen for with the stethoscope is whether the rhythm is regular or whether there could be irregularity of the rhythm, which is sometimes abnormal as well. And if that is heard, then we would go the next step and do an electrocardiogram or an EKG, you might have heard of. And that will tell us whether there are any arrhythmias that could be dangerous and might require treatment. And so the last thing that the veterinarian will typically do is to feel the pulse quality, and that can give us an indication of whether blood going forward is adequate, whether the heart is able to pump well, and whether there might be some arrhythmias as well. And so once the veterinarian has assessed the examination of the patient, they can decide if there's anything there that raises a suspicion of heart disease, in addition to listening to the lung fields as well, and then determine, do I need to do some tests here in my hospital, or would I like to refer this patient to a veterinary cardiologist?
Is an animal's blood pressure ever significant in the way that it is for people?
In people, we're mostly concerned about hypertension, and yes, we do see that in dogs and cats as well. But it can be a little bit tougher to understand whether that is because of nervousness or disease in dogs and cats, because they can become very nervous coming into the hospital. So sometimes we have tried to get them back at a different time in a different environment that's quiet with not a lot of people around, or sometimes even send blood pressure monitors home to try to get a home assessment of blood pressure. So yes, we do see high blood pressure. And then sometimes conversely, if dogs and cats are having some real problems with their heart, the blood pressure might actually be too low.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Can you describe the sound of a heart murmur? Is it unmistakable to a trained clinician?
Yes. So typically the heart sounds would be lub, dub, lub, dub. But with a heart murmur, there's most commonly a blurring of those sounds. So sh, do, sh, do would be a typical heart murmur sound. And so it can be quite apparent once you've heard a couple, but it is often graded on severity. So we grade from a scale of 1 to 6, with 1 being very, very soft and 6 being quite loud. In fact, you can feel a kind of a palpation of the heart murmur through the body wall when it's a 6. And those are quite easy to hear. Grade 1s are quite soft and hard to hear. So our veterinary students that come through the teaching hospital may need to practice a little bit to hear the grade 1s and the grade 2s.
Well, how do you show those examples or demonstrate those examples? You find pets who are experiencing some sort of heart murmur, and you kind of are able to gauge what level that murmur is, and then you're able to demonstrate that to the students?
Yes, that's exactly true. Our students come through the teaching hospital and they participate in the care of the patients that come here for veterinary care. And so we would have for instance, if I am seeing a dog that has a grade 3 heart murmur, which the grades have very specific explanations for what makes a grade 2 and what makes a grade 3, that we can teach the students in the classroom. But there is nothing like having the stethoscope handed over to you and say, this is what a grade 3 murmur sounds like. And so we take that time with the veterinary students who are also caring for these patients so that they can learn the proper evaluation of heart murmurs and other things during their clinical rotations.
The lub-dub sound that indicates a correctly functioning heart, the sound itself, is that created by the opening and closing of these valves?
It's not the exact opening and closing of the valves, but it's associated with that particular timing. So it may have to do with other physical properties of the blood flowing, but it is the first heart sound, the lub, is associated with closure of the AV valves, which would separate the atria and the ventricle. And the second heart sound is associated with closure of the semilunar valves, which are the aortic and the pulmonary valves.
Well, the slightly hissy sound that you indicated the murmur sort of was, that is a result of something not sort of functioning properly, as you said. Are you able to, in those cases in which that happens, take, say, an ultrasound and see that disruption in progress?
Yes, absolutely. So what we're hearing when we hear the shh as of a murmur sound is actually turbulent blood flow that is going at higher than normal velocities and typically varying velocities, and that's what creates that sound. And when we do an ultrasound, which is also called an echocardiogram on dogs and cats that have suspected heart disease, we're looking at a lot of things, but one of the things that we are looking at is where the blood flow is going and relative to the contraction of the heart. And so, for instance, a common heart disease of dogs as they get older is degeneration of the mitral valve, which is between the left atrium and the left ventricle, and that causes that valve to not close properly, so blood leaks backward and we hear a heart murmur. And when we put the ultrasound on that dog to look at what's happening inside the heart, we can actually see that valve leaking and blood going backward instead of going forward like it should.
Wow. Okay. Now, this is where we're going to take a little break. And I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Darcy Aden. We're talking about congestive heart failure in our pets. And we'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Darcy Aden. We're talking about congestive heart failure in pets. And when we left off, Dr. Aden, you'd been mentioning the sort of EKG, I guess it is. And the EKG, is it like a chart? Is it like it probably isn't on paper anymore, but does it have like a line on it that kind of indicates, you know, where in the cycle the heart is in terms of its beating?
Yes, that's right, Dana. The EKG is recorded on paper, and we record it from dogs and cats by attaching electrodes to the skin on their legs, which are very gentle, and they send the signal to the computer, which records the electrical activity of the heart. And that is, there are several different waveforms there, but it looks very similar to the EKG from people. For anyone that might have had one done on themselves, we use the same technology.
I'm interested in this now. This is such a naive question, so excuse me, but the electrical activity, is this different from the pumping activity, distinct, right, from the activity of its actual, like, physically pumping the blood?
It is distinct, but of course related. So the heartbeat that we talked about earlier for, say, 100 beats per minute is controlled by a small group of cells in the right atrium called the sinoatrial node. And those small group of cells have the ability to spontaneously produce a signal or depolarize. And then that signal is spread to the surrounding tissue, first in the atria and then a few milliseconds later down into the ventricles. And that depolarization causes those heart muscle cells to contract. And it's the contraction of those many, many cells around one chamber of the heart that causes the heart to pump blood. And so it's all very well orchestrated and organized so that the atria contract first and then the ventricles. And so there's this coordinated movement of blood through the heart. And then when the ventricles are stimulated by the electrical activity to then contract in a uniform manner, then they pump blood out to the rest of the body. So they're very intimately related.
All right, that's fantastic. So now I understand there's an electrical thing that creates a mechanical function. Perfect. Now, when you look at this EKG of, say, a healthy animal, it probably has a, you know, typical pattern that you would expect to see. When you see an EKG of an animal that you suspect to have a problem with its heart, a kind of a congestive heart failure or disease, that has telltale patterns. Can you describe again what those would look like?
Sure, yes. The EKG is actually our test of choice for detecting a rhythm disturbance, but not necessarily for detecting underlying pumping disease or congestive heart failure. So sometimes we have to complement that with the other tests we talked about. But the EKG will typically be composed of several waveforms when it's normal. There's a P wave when the atria are depolarized, and then there's a QRS complex a little bit later that happens with variable either 1 to 3 waveforms altogether that represent depolarization of ventricles. And then it's followed by a T wave, which represents the relaxation or repolarization of the ventricles. And so we expect that to be normal, but animals that have arrhythmias might have one of those complexes come in too soon, or maybe not come in when they should, or come in from the ventricles instead of from the sinoatrial node. And all of that will produce irregularity in the heart rhythm, either too fast or sometimes too slow.
Now, all of these together, the kind of ultrasound that you might do, the listening, the EKG, can help probably point you to a definitive diagnosis, right?
Yes, they can, yeah.
The underlying cause, though, might still be a mystery. how does one go about determining what has led this animal to experience a problem with its heart?
And that's where some of the research and science in understanding heart diseases of dogs and cats comes in. So you're absolutely right. We can do the EKG to determine if there's a rhythm abnormality, and then we can also do the echocardiogram, which is the ultrasound of the heart, and that will tell us what is the problem. Is it because that mitral valve is leaky? Is there a stenotic valve that an animal was born with, or is the heart muscle potentially too weak? And so some of those things are evident, for example, in an older small breed dog that has a leaky mitral valve that looks thickened, it's probably a degenerative change, and we suspect that that is a genetically based disease for most small breeds of dogs. The research has supported that. But there may be instances where we look at a dog that has poor pumping capacity, so its heart kind of looks flabby and is not pumping as it should, and that could be caused by a number of different things. It could be caused by genetics, or it could be caused by diet, or an infectious disease can do that as well. And we can't necessarily look at that ultrasound and tell for sure. So we might need to do some additional testing like genetic testing or infectious disease testing to try to determine an underlying cause. But there are times that we don't know exactly what led to the disease that we're seeing. And so we are faced with a situation where we try to palliate the disease and make the dogs feel better with medicine without necessarily knowing exactly what led to it.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk to about therapies later in the program. Can we talk a little bit right now about the genetics of this? If this is something that is kind of uncertain in origin, but you suspect it might be a genetic, what can a genetic test reveal to you?
Well, to start with, we have only a small number of genetic markers that have been discovered in dogs and cats with heart disease. In people, there are many more genetic mutations that are known that can cause heart disease, and we're really only starting to scratch the surface of what genetic mutations might be out there causing disease in dogs. And so there are a few genetic markers that we can test for. For example, in Dobermans that have dilated cardiomyopathy, there are two mutations that have been shown to be associated with the disease of dilated cardiomyopathy. But having the genetic marker doesn't mean that you will get the disease, and likewise, not having the genetic marker doesn't necessarily mean that you couldn't get the disease as well. So genetic testing can be very complicated. I view it as a piece of the puzzle. It tells me essentially whether that animal has a risk factor for genetic disease. But there are many other things that will determine whether that genetic mutation is expressed as actual disease. And that those might be environmental that might be different from one animal to another and determine whether that animal will develop disease. So we all like to think that genetic testing is going to be the answer for screening for disease and for trying to improve breeding programs. And it can be helpful, but it is definitely only a piece of the puzzle. There are other things that can influence it.
Are there any dogs for which their breed type alone is predictive of a heart problem?
Well, we certainly know that there are some breeds that are predisposed to heart disease. And again, Doberman Pinschers are definitely predisposed to the development of dilated cardiomyopathy, which is where the heart doesn't pump very well. And we do know that there are some mutations. So they are a well-described genetic predisposition. But there are many other diseases that have breeds that are predisposed to particular diseases. For example, I mentioned earlier that small breed dogs, as they get older, are more prone to developing degenerative mitral valve disease. And in some dogs, that can lead to congestive heart failure. So we know that there are some breeds that are predisposed. And within that population of small breed dogs, there are some breeds that rise to the top as being more predisposed, for instance, Cavalier, King Charles Spaniels.
Does anybody understand why? Like, why Doberman Pinschers? Why, the King Charles Spaniels?
There are researchers working to understand that for sure. The genetic mutations, and I say plural because there might be more than one, associated with degenerative mitral valve disease, and especially in the Cavaliers, have really not been discovered yet. So there are many, many people working on that because these are very popular breeds and they're wonderful dogs. And the same with Dobermans. We might understand that there are some mutations that predispose to it, but exactly what's happening, it causing that is requires more research. And there are a number of veterinary groups around the country and around the world, actually, that are have active programs seeking to understand that better.
What role does age play in the congestive heart failure? Is it seen in animals of all ages?
Congestive heart failure could be seen in animals of all ages because it simply represents the end result of a heart that's failing. So there are a few diseases that animals could be born that they could be born with that could lead to congestive heart failure. In other words, congenital heart defects. But in general, most of the diseases that most of the time when we see congestive heart failure in dogs, it will be middle-aged to older dogs because it does take some time for that heart to fail, essentially. And we mentioned earlier that animals often live with a sick heart for a while before they show signs. And so, for example, cardiomyopathy might not start to present itself till middle age, and so congestive heart failure won't probably be happening in a younger dog. And same with degenerative valve disease, that typically has an age of onset that's somewhere in the middle age, and so with a slow progression over years, so dogs might be, you know, typically on average maybe over 10 when they have actual problems from it.
Okay, so I mean that's pretty old for quite a few dog breeds, 10 years old.
Some live longer, yep.
Yeah. But it is something that at any age can probably be significantly life-limiting if unaddressed.
Absolutely. Without any treatment, it will be life-limiting in a very short period of time because you can't breathe if you have fluid in your lungs. And many, many times, unfortunately, we're not able to reverse the underlying disease, and our goals are to slow progression of disease with medications and provide symptomatic relief. So we are typically looking at diseases that may eventually cause the demise of the pet, but we want to use medications to prolong that as long as possible and make sure the dogs and cats feel really good while they're living with that heart failure.
Can we talk a little bit more about the fluid in the lungs? The difficulty breathing that these animals experience is probably pronounced in cases in which this has been allowed to go on for quite some time.
Yes, although I would say that typically animals would not be lingering with fluid in the lungs for longer than a couple days most often.
Okay.
Need veterinary attention.
Yeah, okay, because it would become so noticeable that the pet owner would have taken notice.
Yep, exactly.
I see. And at that point, once the fluid is there, what can the veterinarian do?
So if a veterinarian is examining a dog or a cat and they suspect that they have congestive heart failure and fluid in their lungs, the first thing that we do is we provide oxygen because oxygen helps to, oxygen needs to get into the lung tissue. And so if we give them more oxygen, it can help to overcome the fluid there. We also give a diuretic, which helps to take fluid off the lungs, by causing that fluid to leave the body through urine. And we can give that diuretic as an intravenous injection, especially in an emergency situation. And then we'll also give medications that can help the heart to pump stronger, which will reduce the fluid buildup and the congestion.
Okay, so there are things that veterinarians can do, and when we come back from this short break, we can talk about strategies for helping these pets kind of manage the problem if it cannot be just totally corrected, and how they might live their best life. That's part of the sort of title of the program today, because what we want is our pet to feel comfortable and to be able to live as well as it can for as long as it can. So we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back with more Animal Airwaves live here on WUFT. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Darcy Aden. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Darcy Aden. And when we left off, Dr. Aden, you had sort of told me what could be done for an animal that had been brought in that was having respiratory distress kind of as a result of some fluid being in the lungs due to this this heart problem. Now, that is a strategy for immediately addressing this animal that is having acute trouble. Long term, what are some of the treatments that are available to these pets so that they can live longer, better lives?
Yeah, we have several treatment options available to us with exactly that goal. We may not be able to change the underlying problem, but we want those pets to live as comfortably as they can once they experience this milestone of congestive heart failure. So that injection of the diuretic that we gave in an emergency situation also comes in an oral form, and we'll often give oral medications as diuretics, which will cause the pets to drink more and to urinate more. So it's important that owners know that they should provide plenty of water and access to either a litter box or to going outside. We also use medications that will increase the pump function of the heart and help it to pump better, essentially, and kind of support it. And those medications have been shown to extend the good quality life that we can give to our pets, who are very fortunate to have those. And then lastly, we typically will give medications to try to quiet the overactive hormone systems that can happen when congestive heart failure occurs. The body kind of goes a little bit overboard, and we see that with higher blood pressures and sodium and water retention. And so there are medications that we can give to kind of scale that back. And those are not medications where we would necessarily see a tangible benefit, but they are helpful for the long run for many patients.
Okay. So with some of these animals, we know that they can be a range of ages, and we know that if one has a heart problem, human being or animal or otherwise, it can be, you know, a life-limiting problem, and one will probably need to change some aspects of one's life and so forth. Are you seeing reasonable success in prolonging or extending the quality life of an animal with the treatment options that are currently available?
Yes, and that's our goal. And it's variable depending on how dogs respond to medications. But our goal is that an ideal goal would be that a dog or a cat does not re-experience congestive heart failure. But that may not be realistic. And so our goal is to extend the time between heart failure episodes as long as possible. And generally, dogs, when they don't have fluid actively on their lungs, feel pretty good, even though their heart may not be functioning properly. And so if we can take the fluid off the lungs, we generally make them feel a lot better. And we do try to set realistic expectations. So these dogs probably won't be athletes if they were before, but they should be able to take a walk around the block and do their normal dog and cat activities that they've been doing before they experience congestive heart failure.
Can you describe how medical therapies address the underlying issues here, or how they are able to help the body to not have some of the symptoms?
Yeah, so one of the things the body does when the heart is failing is it wants to retain salt and water, and that's to help basically increase the blood volume because the heart's failing. So if you provide it with more blood volume, then maybe some will go forward even though a lot goes backward, for example. But that can overshoot And when it overshoots, fluid seeps into the lung tissue. And so what the diuretics do is they cause the dog to urinate more, and then that reduces the blood volume and draws the fluid from the lung tissue back into the blood vascular space and away from the lungs. And so many times, because dogs have underlying disease that is not necessarily being surgically repaired like it might be in people, although there are some centers for that, many times once dogs require diuretics to keep the fluid off their lungs, they continue to require them, and we usually don't withdraw them. So we kind of try to find the diuretic dose that keeps the fluid off the lungs without having them urinate too much. And then, of course, the positive inotropic medications that increase the pump function of the heart are very helpful, because if you can have the heart pump forward better, then less will go backward generally.
Ah, okay. Is surgery ever an option or advised?
The most common disease that we would be thinking about for surgery would be degenerative mitral valve disease, and there's certainly lots of discussion about dogs that might become surgical candidates for that. Right now, there are only a few centers across the world that offer that surgery, and the most famous one is in Japan. And as you probably know, we have had discussions in trying to have that be an offering here at the University of Florida. But currently, there is not a place within the states that is offering that with success. So the vast majority of dogs that we treat with mitral valve disease are treated medically. And so that's where we need to make sure that we are optimizing that, because that's the pathway that we have to try to provide great quality of care and quality of life for the dogs that are suffering, most of the dogs that are suffering from heart failure. Although people certainly can travel to one of those places once COVID restrictions are lifted.
Well, you know, I mean, anytime you're talking about doing surgery, you're talking about a risk. And then anytime you're doing a surgery on the heart, that is probably especially sensitive to surgery, and there is risk there, of course. So medically, if you're able to address it that way, if there are medical therapies that are available that can produce positive results, then, you know, I would think, just kind of as a person who loves animals, that would be probably where I first looked. The medications, are they oral medications generally?
They are generally oral medications, yes. And to get to your point, I absolutely agree. But the benefit of surgery would be that it would correct the problem, and then medications might not be needed, whereas medications aren't correcting the underlying problem. They're just creating some palliation, if you will. But we certainly don't want dogs to be having difficulty breathing or coughing or suffering during that time. We want them to feel pretty good. And I think a lot of times the medications can provide that good quality of life for a period of time.
Okay, so an oral medication might need to be given daily. Is that how it is?
Yes, most often twice a day, and sometimes more frequently up to three times a day.
Ooh, okay. But see, now we're talking then about a real commitment on the part of the pet owner to caring for this animal, because that means if it's three times a day, you're talking about, you know, if you're somebody who works in the morning, maybe coming home at lunch, and then maybe again in the evening.
Yes, and sometimes we'll try to, depending on whether the medication truly needs to be every 8 hours or can be spaced a little differently, we might do before you go to work, when you get home from work, and before you go to bed. But most of the time, it's twice a day medication. But you're absolutely right. It's a commitment, because it's very important that these pets receive that medication in a consistent manner as well. We don't want to skip doses.
Right. Now, anybody who has ever cared for, say, a cat with diabetes, and you have to do treatments multiple times a day and every day, and it becomes a thing where, like, if you go on vacation, you're thinking about it, like, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do with my pet? That this sounds kind of similar to that, that it is something that you would have to make clear to anybody who ever pet sits for you, to it would be part of your planning for what you do if you have to go on a business trip or on holiday.
Absolutely, yep. And it can also be important. Another important aspect can be how readily your pet takes medications. And we do have the ability to compound medications to make them taste a little bit better for some of them. But it is very important that dogs and cats take the medication without too much issue, because it is a lifelong commitment. And you do have to arrange for other people to give those medications when you're going to go on vacation. You're absolutely right.
Which now makes it understandable that some people would choose to seek an option that would permanently address and remedy the problem, though that form of surgery might be complicated and hard to come by.
Yes, and there's many heart diseases that we see that are not amenable to surgery, such as the cardiomyopathies that affect the heart muscle.
Mm-hmm. With cats and with dogs, is there one of those two species that experience this more frequently or with greater destructiveness?
Well, congestive heart failure is going to be the end result of disease, so it can look very similar regardless of the underlying cause. I would say that it's more common that we would find it in dogs than in cats, because the prevalence of degenerative mitral valve disease is pretty widespread once dogs get to be over 10 years of age. I'm not sure that answered your question.
I guess what I'm sort of wondering is, for people who, you know, have a cat, you know, are the various problems that can lead to this more common than they would be for the various problems that would lead to it in dogs?
No, it would be similar. Cats are more prone to an underlying disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which does have a genetic basis and causes the heart muscle to become thickened and not relax very well. And that can lead to congestive heart failure. And that is the most common heart disease we see in cats, but probably a bit less common overall than the mitral valve disease in dogs.
Mm, yeah. The condition you were just describing in cats is one now that rings a bell. I had a kitty many years ago who, as she got older, had this problem. And she still lived a pretty decent long life. It was something that, you know, we were able to kind of, you know, help her cope with as best we could. And my recollection was that she was quite older in any case when it was diagnosed. So, the condition, if you can imagine, the heart needs to be a fairly supple but strong muscle. And if it is becoming too stiff, right? I mean, is that kind of the nature of the problem? Then, you know, it is understandable that this could cause trouble for these pets.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did want to point out also, Dana, that not all dogs and cats that have heart disease will eventually experience congestive heart failure. For instance, in dogs with mitral valve disease, probably only 25% of the population that has the disease will go on to develop congestive heart failure. And so there are other factors that influence that, but some dogs have the disease but to a mild degree and don't ever have consequences from it. So just because your pet has been diagnosed with heart disease, it's an indication to get it evaluated, decide if treatment will be helpful, and establish a monitoring plan, but it doesn't necessarily mean that your pet is going to get congestive heart failure.
And this is a great point, and this is something that can help us end on a positive note today, and that is just the reality that one should not avoid taking one's pet to the veterinarian when suspecting something might be wrong because you are afraid that you're going to hear bad news, because it might be that, okay, there are some symptoms that might suggest a heart problem, but it might not be a problem that is going to definitely end your pet's life.
Absolutely. You might be pleasantly surprised and find out it's mild, or we might find out if it's more severe that there's medications that can delay the progression. And I think most importantly, your veterinarian can teach you what you can do to watch for and be clued into signs of that things are getting worse at home that you might not be aware of. For instance, we often teach our owners to monitor the rate at which dogs and cats breathe while they're sleeping, because that can be a very sensitive indicator. If that rate goes up a little bit, an indicator that we might be in the early stages of heart failure. And the sooner we can get on that, the better it is going to be.
And people are usually fairly alert to abrupt changes in their animal's behavior or so forth, so that if you see anything that strikes you as out of sorts, it might be worth mentioning to your veterinarian.
Absolutely. And your primary family veterinarian is there to help interpret whether those things are important or not and can put it in the whole context of their exam of the patient.
Some of these heart problems can be detected early by a veterinarian during a regular visit, as we talked about during the beginning of the program today. Your pet's veterinarian will probably make some recommendations to you if early on it is kind of diagnosed that the animal has some sort of abnormality. Just before we go, can you describe what, as a veterinarian, you have recommended to people whose pets have some sort of early signs and so that people can kind of understand that it isn't necessarily dire and some of what's recommended might not be terribly difficult to accommodate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important things is once the diagnosis is made is to establish a plan for monitoring, and your veterinarian and the veterinary cardiologist can help determine how frequently we need to reassess your animal. And then I always recommend as I mentioned, I teach owners to take a breathing rate when their pet is sleeping or resting. It's very simple to do. There are apps that can help you track it as well. And once you have a feel for what is normal for your pet, it's even small rises in that breathing rate, which we might not notice as difficulty breathing or struggling or coughing. Even small rises in that breathing rate could indicate that there's something starting there. So there's comfort, I think, in knowing that you will be able to see something when it's coming and won't be a surprise so that you can address it earlier rather than later.
Wonderful advice. Dr. Darcy Aden from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you, Dana. It was my pleasure.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey as well at the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine for her help with the program. And thank you for listening. I hope you can join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.